Episode 254, Gina Mundy, attorney and author of the book, A Parent's Guide to a Safer Childbirth.
So this is a hard one, and I just want to put it out there. I've been reading your book and learning all about the mistakes, and I know this question is subjective, but I remember when I'm
Mark Rabin. This is My Favorite Mistake. In this podcast, you'll hear business leaders and other really interesting people talking about their favorite mistakes. Because we all make mistakes, but what matters is learning from our mistakes instead of repeating them over and over again. So this is the place for honest reflection and conversation, personal growth, and professional success. Visit our website at myfavoritemistakepodcast.com.
To learn more about Gina, her book, and more, look for links in the show notes or go to markrabin.com/mistake254. As always, thanks for taking time to listen. And now, on with the show.
Hi, welcome back to My Favorite Mistake. I'm Mark Rabin. Our guest today is Gina Mundy. She's author of the book, A Parent's Guide to a Safer Childbirth, Expecting the Best, Using the Power of Knowledge to Help You Deliver a Healthy Baby. So Gina is an attorney who specializes in childbirth cases. Throughout her career, Gina has traveled nationwide, engaging with healthcare professionals, including doctors, nurses, and midwives to explore all aspects of labor and delivery. So we'll be able to talk about that today, including some of the issues that can arise, unfortunately, during labor and delivery that would impact both the mother and baby. So I'll link to Gina's full website and full bio in the show notes. She lives in my home state. She's in Michigan with her family, which includes her husband, her kids, and dogs. And her bio says she enjoys visiting wineries. So that's something else we have in common. Welcome to the podcast, Gina. How are you?
Thank you, Mark, for having me. I am doing great, and I am excited for our conversation today.
Yeah. And before we get into that, I have to ask, not to get too sidetracked on wine, do you have a favorite region or winery or wine to visit and or open up at home?
Oh, yeah. So Niagara-on-the-Lake. So you know where Niagara Falls is? Niagara-on-the-Lake is right there. And it's like a secret winery place and just filled with the most amazing wines. So that by far is my favorite. And then I really enjoy the Michigan wines. I have been hitting the Michigan wineries last few years a lot. It seems like they've really nailed it down on how to make some good wine. So there's Marquette Winery in Ludington, and that is probably by far one of my most favorite wineries.
Well, cool. I'll have to go check that. I'll expand my horizons and support my home state a little bit someday and check that out. So, okay. So this is not the My Favorite Winery podcast. That might be fun to do someday. Maybe that would be popular, but we are going to talk about mistakes as we always do. So Gina, I would love to hear your story. What would you say is your favorite mistake?
So this is a hard one, and I just want to put it out there. I've been reading your book and learning all about the mistakes, and I know this question is subjective, but I remember when I first thought of my answer, it was literally 10 years ago. So I'm a partner at my law firm, and I'd been a partner at the time, and I had just had my third baby and child, and he's not a baby anymore. And basically, I had gone to my firm and I'm like, listen, I'm capped out. I'm tired. I'm exhausted. It was Christmas. I have my little man. I got my two girls. And I'm also married to a pretty busy business owner. And so I felt like my kids were like little orphans running around. So I had gone to my firm and I'm like, I can't do this. I quit. And they were like, okay, you're stressed out over the holidays. You need to go on vacation. And when you come back, we'll talk about it. And that was over Christmas. And I didn't really work. I kind of kept an eye on my cases. We didn't really talk about it. It was kind of odd, I'll be honest. And then I think we were into April and I called, I don't remember, my kind of boss at the time. And I'm like, listen, you guys got to stop paying me. I think I'm really going to quit. And I mean, I had health insurance benefits. It was great. I'm like, this is crazy. I mean, I keep an eye on my cases, making sure nothing bad. There's other people working on them. Yeah. Whatever. So they were like, well, if you could come in and just argue one more thing. And it was against a pretty prominent attorney in our community, actually, since you know it, it was Jeff Feiger. And could you,
could you come in?
It was a baby case I had worked up. And he's like, can you argue, you know, this against him? And then we'll go to lunch and then we'll figure out, you know, if there's something that we can accommodate you or whatever. And so that day I went and argued against him and we ended up, you know, we were pretty happy with the results. So then we went to lunch. So it was interesting because that kind of got me on my high again. You know, I'd had my long break and whatever. But basically then we decided that I would actually stay, you know, at the firm and that I would not quit. And we made some adjustments or whatever. So that was 10 years ago. And now that my, you know, so I just continued to work instead of going to be a stay at home mom, which is kind of what I wanted to do. So now 10 years later, you know, my kids are older, they're 20, 16, 10. And I feel like, did I miss something? I kept working. So, you know, that's always been, I don't know. I've always struggled with that. I never did try to quit again. I did try to pay more, you know, focus on the family as much as I could or whatever, but no, I stayed and, you know, I continued to work over the next, you know, 10 years.
So, I mean, it sounds like as you're thinking through this and, you know, and thank you for sharing that and your reflections, because part of the subjectivity is trying to decide, was it a mistake? Mm-hmm. It sounds like you're still, I appreciate the process of still trying to think through that. Was it a mistake what were some of the adjustments that were made in terms of, was it a matter of having fewer cases, having better balance to be home more that made it seem okay, at least so, during that time?
Yeah. So I basically, it's interesting. My office is right next to where you grew up. But that is about an hour from my house. So one of the adjustments was I don't need to come in anymore. So it was, you know, it was things like, but that's huge. That's 2 hours in my day. Okay. Well, now I have two more hours. Plus I don't have to get ready. So there's an extra few minutes too, or whatnot. But I could probably, you know, finish the full thought on the good part of that decision. Or I don't know if you wanted to ask me about it.
No, go ahead.
So to come full circle with my mistake, my favorite mistake, because I did stay in my industry and whatnot. So I'm an attorney specializing in the childbirth cases. So then 19 years deep into my profession, I wrote a book and I wrote a book to expecting parents on how to basically avoid these mistakes and complications that I've seen now for 21 years and have a healthy baby. And I can tell you right now, if I would have left the industry 10 years ago, I would not have written this book to parents. There is absolutely no way that, you know, I wouldn't have had the knowledge base. I wouldn't have kept my foot in the door. I wouldn't have continued working up these cases. And just so your audience understands, when I say there's a childbirth case or a case involving childbirth, these are cases involving the birth of a baby when there's a mistake or a complication. And basically something goes wrong and baby is not born healthy. Babies may pass away during childbirth. In some sad cases, mom's passed away. So basically, as the attorney, I come in and I figure out what happened, what went wrong, why, and what should have been done so baby was born healthy or mom around to raise her baby. So, you know, again, like you had said, these questions have taken me all over the United States, meeting with delivery teams, hashing out every aspect of labor and delivery. I still continued to travel even with my different schedule, but I continued to travel and still learn and whatever. But again, staying in the industry then helped me to have the knowledge base and the foundation to write this book to help other families. So when I made that decision, basically, I've always gotten involved in the aftermath of something going wrong. Now, with writing this book, I'm trying to get involved before childbirth. So hopefully prevent these mistakes.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's a lot to explore there. I should have let you finish your closing statement. You hadn't made your closing statement.
I'm like, I can come full circle with the mistake aspect.
Yeah. Not that we're not wrapping up the case here, meaning the episode. But yeah, so I mean, I hear, like, even if you're still wondering, like, you know, what was it a mistake to not quit? It led to something positive. You know, you're proud of the book, and we'll talk more about what you've learned and what mothers and hospitals need to be doing. But like, without, I'm not trying to pry too much into, you know, family life, but since you brought it up, your kids are now 10 and what ages, like, there's still that nagging doubt of, like, what might have been different had you stayed home with them, or just that lingering what if.
Well, now that they're older, you know, the 20-year-old's going to be out soon. The 16-year-old, if she announces one more time that she's leaving when she's 18, I'm just like, oh my goodness, I know you're leaving when you're 18. But, you know, all of a sudden, I just feel like I'm getting really close to, wait a minute, now I have all the time in the world to work. I can work all day, every day, is, you know, obviously. And then my 10-year-old, you know, he's becoming way more independent. He's very into sports. If you can't throw a football, he does not want to hang out with you. So on Sunday, I literally had to sit and throw a football back and forth. Otherwise, I don't think he'd talk to me. So if you want time with the kid, you have to throw a football, you know? So I'm like, wait a minute, did I miss something? Cause now that I realize, you know, I'm 48, so, you know, I do have I have many more working years. So I'm just hoping I didn't miss out on too much of that, you know, mommy homemaker stuff or Susie homemaker stuff.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, still, I mean, I guess maybe it's a situation where only more time will be more telling.
Right.
The opportunity to take advantage of the time you do have when they do enjoy being around you.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm like, well, we'll see how I do as a grandma. We'll see if I can get my act together as a grandma.
Yeah. Again, our guest today, Gina Mundy. Gina, tell us more about your path into, you know, this focus, this study, this passion around trying to help prevent childbirth mistakes.
So writing a book was never on my radar until we had, like, a near tragic family event. So my sister's oldest daughter was pregnant, and she basically had a birth experience that was very, very scary. The day that she went into labor, I was 1,100 miles away that day. And I remember it was 5 o'clock, March 17th, and I was in my kitchen, and my phone rang, and my kids ran over because they were waiting to hear the good news that cousin Sam, you know, had the first baby of our next generation. And I answered the phone, and it was speakerphone. And instead of hearing, you know, she had a girl, it was my sister hysterically screaming, "The baby crashed, the baby crashed." And obviously I just ran out the door so my kids could not hear their Aunt Kelly screaming. And I went outside and I sat on my porch listening to her cry hysterically. And of course, my lawyer brain was going through her labor, like, what happened? What happened? And it, you know, it's interesting because her labor had gone very similar to how a legal baby case goes, because there are common facts, there are common issues that occur in these cases. And it was right there. I mean, it was scary watching it unfold. But then as I listened to my sister cry, I went from, you know, my attorney analysis to a human analysis. And I'm like, this is how the families feel. And it was awful. And it was like, there was, you know, at that point, no decision now is going to change the past. And you can just sit and you can hope and you can pray. And that's what I did. And we did get news that the baby was going to be okay. But, you know, that moment really, it just stuck with me. And it was hard that day. That weekend was hard. It was a Friday at 5 that we'd gotten the phone call, and it was just a hard weekend. And then I realized, what if I'm not around for the birth of my grandkids? Or, you know, what if I'm 1,100 miles away? And then I'm like, wait a minute, I need to start writing down what I know, because there are common facts, there are common issues, like I just said. And I can tell you, as an attorney specializing in childbirth cases, how I would prepare my family for childbirth is completely different than how a normal family, you know, who doesn't know what I know, would prepare. So I started writing everything down. And as I wrote it down, it was like a floodgate of information. And I quickly figured out that this is information that could not only help, you know, my kids have healthy kids, but it could help families across the world have health, you know, healthy babies.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you for doing that. And hopefully there were no ill effects for that baby as they were growing up.
Yeah, our baby is fine. So there's, you know, in these cases, there's a lot of, you know, there's close calls, and we landed on the right side of a close call. In my cases, it's the other side. It's the wrong side of a close call that, you know, a lot of times, you know, end up in the baby cases. Because unfortunately, families can be one decision or minutes from a healthy baby.
Right. Yeah. And the bad outcomes range from death to lifelong disability.
Right.
As a result of some of these mistakes. And I guess that's where the legal battles and the settlements become potentially huge. The cost of care, a lifetime of, let's say, special care for a child who's been harmed during a childbirth mistake.
Oh, yeah. It's astronomical. It's a lot of money to care for, you know, a baby that has suffered a significant brain injury during birth.
Mm-hmm. So when there's a bad outcome, and this is probably what gets litigated, trying to distinguish between a naturally occurring bad outcome versus something that was clearly caused by a mistake. Like, is that, that's where the legal battle comes into play?
Exactly. It's, you know, whether there was anything that could have been prevented. Sometimes, you know, unfortunately, a baby will come in with a pre-existing brain injury before mom even walks in the door. Those babies also have a hard time transitioning from intrauterine life inside mom to, we call it, extrauterine life. So yeah, distinguishing, is this a baby that had a pre-existing injury and just then couldn't handle labor, or was it something that happened during labor? Yeah, that's a huge issue in the cases.
Yeah. So what are some of the most common problems, or you know, especially problems caused by a mistake within the delivery room?
Oh, that's chapter 11 of my book, which makes it different than any other pregnancy book, goes over the top 10. I'll give you the top three. Number one, the most common fact in a legal baby case is the drug called Pitocin. Pitocin is the drug that is used to induce mom's labor. So if you hear of, okay, I'm going in for an induction of labor, that's going to happen with Pitocin. So when there is a mistake or there's a complication, typically Pitocin is involved. So number two.
Well, and what goes wrong? Is it the wrong dose of that medication, or what's the mistake involved with that medication?
So it's all over the board. Sometimes Pitocin, it doesn't have to be the direct cause of the problem. Sometimes it is, but I'll tell you, take it as it is. It's in almost every case. When it does become a problem in many cases, it's because it is a dosage issue. So Pitocin is a very individualized drug, meaning how one person responds to it is completely different than how someone else responds to it. So, you know, if you have a doctor, and I'll tell you, I don't know how much you know about Pitocin. Across the board.
I know nothing.
So. Okay. So across the board, there is agreement that Pitocin can be administered safely and it can be a good option for some moms. Absolutely. It comes into you know, individual circumstances where maybe they're increasing it too fast, too much, and that makes mom contract too much. Because I'll tell you, you know, I'm known for saying this, but contractions suck. Contractions suck. You're a guy, but contractions do suck. I'm sure you've heard. And mom's lucky. Mom can get an epidural. Contractions, though, I think what parents don't realize also suck for baby. And it's because when baby is in the uterus, when there's a contraction, the uterus squeezes down on the baby. When that happens, the oxygen to baby stops. Now, nobody freak out. I know everyone freaks out when I say that. No one freak out. Babies are literally made to handle contractions. However, Pitocin, those are artificial contractions. You want to try to mimic what your natural contractions would be, and that can be very difficult. So making sure you take the slow and steady, let it hit your sweet spot method is definitely going to help you have a safe Pitocin induction. Because what happens is, a lot of times in these cases, there's too many contractions, and then it's just, they describe a contraction like going underwater. So just imagine, so during the contraction, baby's like underwater, you're underwater. As the contraction releases, you come up for air. So if you keep contracting underwater, the baby can only handle so much, i.e. that, you know, when my sister called, the baby crashed. I'm like, ah, crap, too many contractions, you know? So that's probably the main thing. So, you know, and just so your audience understands, in my book, while I may identify, hey, listen, Pitocin is the number one most common fact in a baby case. It's a drug that, you know, I have seen and analyzed since February 2003 when I had my first case. So then I have a chapter on this is what parents need to know to have a safe Pitocin induction. So, but number two, this one shouldn't surprise you. A busy labor and delivery unit. So many times I sit and I meet with people and they're like, I remember that day. It was extremely busy. So that's basically, you know, everybody's running hard. They're running thin. So that definitely is a common fact in the baby cases.
That kind of environment is just going to lead to more human error. That's just a fact. It's part of our human nature. When we're under stress, when there's too much going on, we get distracted, we forget. That's a mistake factory, that kind of environment.
Oh, 100%. And so in that scenario, so that's why I wrote the book to parents. Okay, listen, you roll up to the hospital and you got a busy labor and delivery unit. This is what you need to do. This is what you need to understand and whatnot. And listen, mom's in labor. She needs to focus. So, you know, I give them other ways to handle it. Like, okay, dad, time for you to step up. You know, instinctively, you know, men want to protect their wife. They want to protect their baby. I tell them how to do that, you know, in the book. Or, you know, grandmas are actually loving my book too, because a lot of moms show up because they've had their, you know, for grandkids. I will. And that's going to be me. Grandma's going to be there waiting. But again, identify the problem, but families, this is how you can make sure if you do roll up, this is what you need to know to make sure that, you know, nothing like that happens to, you know, your baby.
Yeah.
Give
us a third.
Yes. Number three, most mistakes and complications occur after mom's water breaks. So that basically what happens, baby's hanging out in the uterus with the placenta, with the umbilical cord. So placenta is all the nutrients for baby. Umbilical cord's like the lifeline. And then everything is surrounded by this fluid. So when the water or that fluid, the amniotic fluid, comes out of mom and it leaves that environment changes. And it can leave, you know, baby can be more susceptible to an injury or something, or something happening inside. So once the water breaks, it's very important to do, you know, certain things. But also with that one, you know, I hear a lot of doctors recommend, hey, let's break your bag of water. Okay. So my point with getting that out there to families is like, that's a really big decision. this is not, this is, no, if baby is sitting pretty, you know, and everything's fine, don't be careful about breaking your bag of water. So, you know, if the doctor says, hey, I'm going to break your bag of water, you know, I think I wrote in the book, literally word for word, you know, mom, dad should look at the doctor and say, is there a medical reason why you want to break my water? Or do you want to be home for dinner? Listen, as a childbirth attorney, I've heard both. So they do, they will break water if they have something to do. Unfortunately, now listen, a physician may be listening to this and be like, I would never do that. Great. You're a great doctor. I'm glad. Please. It's like every profession. You know, you have people who do different things. So this is not across the board to all doctors by any means. I know some amazing OBGYNs who would not do that.
Yeah. I've heard there was one hospital system I was working with that was really trying to push back when mothers were potentially making a mistake in choosing a day for an elective C-section. And, you know, they have a lot of data that that shows, you know, if that elective C-section is done too early, mm-hmm. maybe at the doctor's choosing, or a lot of times it was the mother's choosing. They would have situations where mom wanted the baby born on a day that was cute or meaningful to them. I want to have a Halloween baby. I want to have my baby born on my mom's birthday. I want to have my baby born on whatever the reasons are, like the hospital was in that situation where, you know, people in healthcare would say the customer is not always right. If mom says, I want you to induce me and it's too early, for a good outcome, you know, this hospital was getting better at communicating and basically saying no. Mm-hmm. Now the mother might be upset from a patient satisfaction standpoint, but I mean, come on, the safety of the baby has got to be the most important thing.
Oh, 100%. And if the hospital or doctor, if it's too early, then they're making a good decision. So, yeah. You know what? And if she doesn't like it, she can go somewhere else.
And I think that happened in some cases. So,
yep. Sorry. But no, definitely, no. You know, you have this innocent, helpless baby. And if you have a mom flaking out that she wants to have a Halloween baby at the risk of having a healthy baby, absolutely. That, no, put your foot down. 100%.
Yeah. You know, I think, you know, there's systemic factors like, you know, how busy, how well staffed is the unit? I wonder, like, does time of day or day of week matter? Like when in the story you told earlier, when you said it was Friday at 5 o'clock, like in my head, maybe I'm, you know, overreacting, but a little bit of a warning bell goes off like that. Was that a time of day where, I don't know, you know, maybe some staff had gone home or, you know, I'm not trying to blame the individuals, but I'm thinking like an overnight delivery, an early Sunday morning delivery, are there certain times of day where, I don't know, because of fatigue or other reasons, there might be more mistakes. Shipping. Have you seen that at all?
Yeah. No, you're right. No, there. That's actually a great question. I address it in the book. Actually, that's one of the most that more common factors in a baby case is shift change. There's number four.
You got it.
Number four. Ding, ding, ding. Oh. Yes, shift change. Yeah. Yes, you have. So labor and delivery is, you probably know this, 12 hours. So you have people who have now done a 12-hour shift, especially during the night. And then you have a fresh day shift coming on. There's definitely, I have a lot of shift changes, 100%. And then in terms of timing or a month, so in Michigan, the labor and delivery units are really busy. May, June, and July. Those are like the busy times. And then the other busy times are in the morning. So those are definitely the busier times, May, June, and July. And another, now I did not include this in the book, but hospitals that are teaching institutions that have residents, doctors, and training, basically these are, you know, kids, I can say kids these days because I'm, you know, aging, the kids that basically they just go to school, their nose is in the books, they get into a residency program and now they get to practice on mommies, you know?
They're still doctor kids.
I know, they're doctor kids.
But they don't have that practical experience. And yes, not just in labor and delivery. Medical mistakes in general are much higher in that month of July.
That's there. I didn't include that. I did not include that in the book.
I'm not trying to get all of the top.
That is definitely, definitely a time where I've had more cases in July and August than any other month. Actually, I ended up doing a chart. I tallied everything with a lot of the cases, and by far July and August had the most tallies. And nothing again, there are some amazing residents, but that's what people, you know, there are some really good residents, there are some other residents, but I'm sorry, it is what it is. But they, you know, they have these residents really running the show on labor and delivery. And, you know, but again, they haven't had that hands-on experience. So sometimes things, you know, get missed.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, I would say that's part of that systemic problem. And I mean, the, you know, you've got the resident, let's say they're making decisions. They're supposed to be supervised by an attending who is like the professor, doctor. If something goes wrong, I mean, do they both get sued or does that fall mostly on the attending?
They both get sued.
They both get sued. So welcome to healthcare. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely, yeah. Because the residents are always jumping up and down saying, I was under the doctor. And I'm like, sorry, you're going to get criticized just like the doctor is going to get criticized. It happens in all the cases. So,
yeah. So what advice would you have for a mother or loved ones who are helping a mother make a decision in terms of preventing mistakes? How much of it is a matter of choosing to have labor and delivery in one facility versus another? Like, I love data, but, you know, is there data that shows which hospitals tend to have better outcomes?
Not that I'm aware of. I mean, I really focus on just individual cases. Because a lot of, I do podcasts. People ask me like the data and maternal morbidity, all that stuff. And I'm like, I don't know.
Well, but even from your experience, do you see kind of, you know, clusters of like, yeah, there's more cases involving these certain facilities? Or that's sort of out of the scope of what you're
looking at? Yeah, I don't really look. I mean, everything is just a case comes in, we look at it. So it's hard to say if there's one facility over another getting sued more.
And I'm going to just wonder out loud. I'm curious what thoughts you have around what's discovered through the legal process, through a case about the mistakes, the causes, different contributing factors. A hospital and the physician are going to defend that case. But how often does that information then get fed back to help drive improvement, to help prevent the next mistake and prevent the next case, legal case?
I think it depends on the hospital and the hospital system. Some hospitals have really good methods on if there's a problem, you know, then they want to have suggestions on how to fix that problem. They identify the problem. I think just the hospital systems are very different in that respect. I think some work really hard to learn from their mistakes, while others, you know, don't have the systems in place to allow them to do that.
Yeah. One other question I wanted to ask you, Gina, you know, and this is, I think, part of, you know, systemic issue, thinking of like workplace culture and hierarchy. You know, how often are there disagreements or challenges, let's say, when it comes to nurses and the physicians? Of the nurses wanting to speak up, if the nurse spoke up and was listened to, that might have prevented some sort of problem. Like in your visits of different hospitals, I think when we talked before, you've had a lot of conversations with nurses who have a lot of ideas about how things should be different.
100%. That is more of, you know, since I have published my book. For instance, Pitocin. Nurses love my Pitocin chapter. They are like, thank you for writing this down, because we're constantly getting, You know, the doctors are constantly on us, up, 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 up. And the nurse, so the doctors typically are not at the bedside. Doctors are called in to catch the baby. It's the nurses that are running the Pitocin induction. But if the induction is taking too long, then the doctors will be like, up, up, up. And, you know,
they're rushing it.
They're rushing it, which is a problem. A huge problem, by the way. And so when they're doing stuff like that, it depends on the nurses. The more senior nurses are, you know, they'll give pushback a little bit. The newer nurses, listen, labor and delivery is rough. And I've heard from so many nurses over 21 years. I mean, it takes a good 5 years to figure out how to be a really good labor and delivery nurse. So then a doctor is telling you to up, up everything. You're learning, you know, maybe you up it even though you don't want to. But no, the nurses absolutely love my book because they have not had this in writing before, that Pitocin is the number one most common fact and issue in a baby case, meaning when a baby's not born healthy, Pitocin is typically involved in the case. And then, you know, I've also analyzed this drug again since February 2003. I've seen that induction's gone wrong. You know, Utah, I mean, I've done so much research on this drug. So then I wrote this chapter, which the nurses love. So I've had nurses, I have one traveling nurse right now, and she takes my book to all of the hospitals for the, and she puts it at the nursing station on labor and delivery for the nurses to go through saying, listen, if you don't want to up it, just point to Gina Mundy's book, you know? So yeah, no, the nurses, they've had nothing to stand on until my book was published. And they're out there. I mean, I'm in podcasts with a labor and delivery nurse, Kelly Hoff, called The Birth Journey. I mean, she just loves the Pitocin chapter. She was like, she's like, all my nursing friends, you know, she's like, here you go. This is the ammunition you finally have against these doctors who want to keep upping it. So yeah, no, it's, you know, the labor and delivery nurses, they are like my favorite people. You know, even in my cases, they show more human emotion than any, you know, other fact witness for the defense. They're amazing humans. They're trying to help these moms. And sometimes I think they feel like their hands are tied. But, you know, there is information in my book that's definitely helping them to be able to speak up and have a basis for it finally.
Yeah. In a situation like that, as you've talked about, the doctor saying up, 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 that leads to harm to the baby. Is the nurse also getting sued, or is that the doctor's decision?
Oh, no, they up it. They're getting sued. And that's what they don't like that answer. The nurses do not like that answer. But I've been talking with the nurses and I'm like, listen, you up that Pitocin. Cause they're like, well, do we just chart that we disagree with it? I'm like, yeah, you're incriminating yourself, but go ahead. No. The thing is you have to advocate. You have to go to your charge nurse. You have to go to a different doctor. Tell them you are not comfortable with upping the Pitocin. And this is why you're going to have to advocate. It's called going up the chain of command. Now, some hospital systems and nurses do that more frequently. Maybe smaller rural hospitals don't do that as much or whatnot. But no, I'm like, you're on the hook. If you up it, if you think upping it may harm the baby and you don't do anything, you are 100% on the hook.
And then there's a choice of you might get yelled at. That's better than getting sued. And it's better for the baby.
Yeah. Ultimately, the goal is the delivery team's primary responsibility is to deliver a healthy baby. That is what they are responsible for. In these childbirth cases, it is the care of the delivery team that is at issue and analyzed more than any other aspect of the case.
Yeah. Yeah. So one other question about, you know, the nurse pushing back, let's say if, you know, spouse or partner of the mother has read this chapter, they're aware of this risk. They're in the delivery room. Like you're not really in a position to micromanage the doctor or to say, you might be upping it too much. Like that probably doesn't happen.
Should. So yeah. I've been on, you know, it's interesting. I've been on a lot of like podcasts, and it's a lot of moms actually who have started podcasts because they had such a horrific Pitocin induction, and that's literally traumatized them, you know, as humans. And so I had one mom, she had to have a second Pitocin induction because her husband was getting deployed. And that second, so her first one was so traumatic. Baby was okay, but it was very traumatizing. So the second Pitocin induction, she was like, she talked about it to her doctor during the pregnancy, not at the hospital. She said, listen, I want it slow. I want it steady. Before it is increased, I want to know. I want it only increased by one, not two. Basically, I was so proud of her during that podcast that I was actually blown away, because what she's recommending is exactly what my chapter says. And so, no, listen, mom is the decision maker in labor and delivery. The delivery team, the doctor, the nurse, the midwife, the resident, and anybody else there are technically medical advisors. Mom makes the decision. So if mom or dad, probably mom because it's her body, mom's like, you know, if you're going to have an elective Pitocin induction, again, this is discussion during the pregnancy. How much are you going to increase it? So if you want it increased by one and not two, a doctor should accommodate that. And if a doctor doesn't, get a new doctor. And not only that, you know, you want to know how often is it going to be increased, and then make sure they tell you. So we talked about my niece's labor. She was on Pitocin, and I had to go give them the Pitocin rundown real quick. That the delivery team never increased her Pitocin without telling her. They actually asked her if they could increase the Pitocin, and then they explained why, and together they made a good decision.
Yeah. Yes, that kind of partnership. And I feel like I made a mistake in how I framed that previous question. I'm not a parent. I've never been in a labor and delivery room. So I'm exposing my ignorance about all this. When I asked about the husband or spouse or partner, I wasn't trying to take away the mother's agency over her body and birth. But I think I asked it that way, thinking of like, well, if the mother's in pain, or I think I made a mistake. And so
actually, Mark,
for not asking that.
No, you didn't make a mistake at all. Actually, there's a whole chapter in my book on that. So basically, because mom is in labor and mom has to physically and mentally focus on delivering the baby, dad actually needs to step up to the plate and, again, protect his wife, protect the baby. And again, that's what my book tells them how to do. But in doing that, he needs to be an advocate. His wife needs to be able to look at him, give him the look, the nod, whatever. And husband needs to act and move and know how. Again, my book will help him know how to do that. So no, the husbands actually are one of the keys, literally, to having a healthy baby by sitting there and, you know, protecting his wife, protecting, you know, his baby. So no, that is 100%. You know, I think up until my book was written, I think dads didn't really know what to do, you know, during labor and delivery. So this really lays out, this is what you need to know. This is how you can help your wife. So no, dad's a huge, huge role in having a healthy baby, 100%. And I can tell you from what I've seen in my cases, if dads would have known some of the information that is in my book, you know, it's possible that, you know, they would have had a different outcome.
Yeah. Well, hopefully it's all a team in that labor and delivery room. Parents, nurses, doctors, everybody involved. You know, hopefully, I think a better team environment is going to lead to better outcomes. So
that is definitely what is stressed in my book. It's everybody working together. You know, when I say, for instance, the delivery team, they get busy, they're running hard, they're running thin. Okay, then this is what you need to do to work with your delivery team to make sure that they understand what's going on. Because listen, if, you know, the delivery team is missing something, or your baby's in trouble, or you're in trouble, it's important to be able to work with them, because the delivery team, it's almost like a treat when they're busy like this, like a triage. So if mom or baby over here is in trouble, but you know, this mom may have stalled out in labor, but the baby's fine, they're going to go to mom and baby that's in trouble. I mean, they're unequivocally going to do that. They're going to beeline for them and fix it, you know? So, but as long as they know, and that's where the family comes in. Is again, it's more working with your delivery team again to make sure you're all on the same page. Yeah, this is, you know, a lot of when I log on to podcasts or people look me up, everyone's like, well, which side do you represent? Or, you know, they'll ask me, and I'm like, listen, when I'm out here talking about my book, How to Have a Safe, you know, delivery or whatever, you know, I don't even, this is not an adversarial proceeding. This is about everybody coming together, everybody working together. So the baby is born healthy. So mom is around to raise her baby. And that's what the most important thing is. Obviously the lawyer part of me, that's an adversarial proceeding. And that's, you know, that's a bit different.
Well, Gina, thank you for, you know, sharing your stories and knowledge here. I hope it helps people. Pointing them to your book, I know, is going to help them a lot. So our guest today, again, Gina Mundy. You can, her website is ginamundy.com. We'll put links in the show notes. Her book is A Parent's Guide to a Safer Childbirth, Expecting the Best, Using the Power of Knowledge to Help You Deliver a Healthy Baby. So Gina, thank you for your knowledge and for your caring and advocacy, you know, around all of this. Thank you so much.
And you, Mark, you are so welcome. And I just want to throw this out there that I have been reading your book, and thank you for putting that out there, because I think I make more mistakes than even just in my life as a mom or whatever. And but just, you know, having your perspective on them, cherishing them, learning from them. You know, if somebody in my house makes some mistakes, understanding and being kind. But yeah, your book is definitely an amazing book. I've learned so much from it. And let me tell you, I've recommended it to so many people.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And, you know, maybe down the road, we could do another episode with you and your attorney hat on, talking about fear of mistakes in the courtroom and going up against Jeffrey Figer. There's so much more we could talk about. So maybe someday.
I love it. Great idea.
Thanks a lot, Gina.
Yeah.
Well, again, thanks to Gina Mundy for being here with us today. To learn more about Gina and her book, look for links in the show notes or go to markgraven.com/mistake254. As always, I want to thank you for listening. I hope this podcast inspires you to reflect on your own mistakes, how you can learn from them or turn them into a positive. I've had listeners tell me they started being more open and honest about mistakes in their work. And they're trying to create a workplace culture where it's safe to speak up about problems, because that leads to more improvement and better business results. If you have feedback or a story to share, you can email me, myfavoritemistakepodcast@gmail.com. And again, our website is myfavoritemistakepodcast.com.